I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about an approach to developing creativity and enhancing problem-solving skills. We're going to talk about makerspaces. We'll discuss what they are, how they work, and what we hope to accomplish with them. My guests are first makerspace founder Kim Brand, Vice President of Operations Adam Brand, and Creativity Director Arlen Bayless. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about makerspaces. They're an approach to enhancing creativity and developing problem-solving skills that is fascinating. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are first makerspace founder Kim Brand, his son, who is also the vice president of operations, Adam, and Arlen Bayless, who's the creativity director for First Makerspace. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you here. Well, we probably ought to start by talking a little bit about what a makerspace is. Just paint me a word picture of what one looks like or what one does. We'll start with you, Kim. How's that?
Well, they're sort of like golf courses. You'd recognize them, but no two are the same. Mm-hmm. They are a collection of tools and tables, supplies, materials. It's an environment where, in our case, kids, but there are also adult makerspaces, can make whatever they want. They get the help of a community. They get the resources of the room. As I mentioned, the tools. It's a place where you come in with an idea and you leave with something you've made, and that's an incredibly motivating opportunity for most people.
And, you know, in terms of, you said it's a room, or does it have to be a room, or is it, what other?
Well, I suppose I've described it before by saying that the first makerspace is between your ears. Mm-hmm. So it's helpful if you have an experience, if you have a maker mindset. And to your point, it doesn't need to be a whole room. In schools where we've built makerspaces, it could be about the size of a classroom, or it could be a closet where you store materials and tools that you'd pull out during a particular instructional unit. But it, in all places and means, as far as I know, inspires creativity and problem solving, like you said at the open.
Arlen, talk to me a little bit about what a makerspace is supposed to accomplish.
Well, one of the interesting things about the makerspace culture is that they incorporate both high-tech and low-tech. So this is not a thing where people are just trying to shun a lot of early technical computer type of things. It's a really nice combination of those two. So there's an embracing of these technologies, and some of the special things that happen in makerspaces happen because of these technologies are working together. Collaboration is really important, and embracing all kinds of ideas. So it's not possible to say that there's any one particular goal with the makerspace. There's many different goals. I think collaboration and broadening people's abilities to develop their ideas is a big part of it. And that's why it's so exciting for education.
Well, I'll toss this out to all three. Because we are primarily talking about education in this context so far, what are the educational outcomes that one hopes to see from makerspaces and making use of them? Adam.
Well, the primary goal that we see for makerspaces is to increase enthusiasm for learning. we have found and experienced in our makerspaces and the programming that goes on within these makerspaces that that there is a great increase in enthusiasm and engagement. Children that may struggle in a traditional classroom environment might find themselves much more engaged in that making environment. Mm-hmm. It's quite a bit different than the traditional in-school experience, and what we're trying to do as a company in our mission is to make more making accessible to everyone, but we feel that the greatest impact could be made with those children that would not otherwise have access to these types of tools and experiences in their home life.
So real quickly, walk me through them. What if I wanted to create a makerspace, let's assume that I am principal or a school board member for a school, what does one look like? What sorts of things are going to be at the makerspace?
Let me begin by saying it takes a champion, and mm-hmm. there's no lack of them. Mm-hmm. We've met some incredibly inspiring teachers and educators who have the very best for their kids in mind, and maker spaces and making mindset is the principal sort of ingredient when you begin your journey towards having what someone from the outside might experience as a makerspace, but which all along had existed inside that school. To get to your point about what are the outcomes, I think we talk about 21st century skills, mm-hmm. Critical thinking, problem solving, creativity. But what I would tell to administration for a school is it can start for free. Pick up recyclables. There are plenty of examples of kids using cardboard to create the most amazing sculptures. Of course, you can move up the food chain from there with hand tools and sewing machines, with sign-making gear, and, of course, 3D printers and laser cutters. So it can span the spectrum, but I think the first and most important ingredient is a maker culture, like Arlen talked about.
Arlen, and what is a maker culture?
Well, in old days we might have thought of this as shop class, but it looks nothing like a shop class because, of course, it includes a lot of equipment that never existed in shop class. But what's similar about it is that it engages students' minds in a way that they were engaged in shop class. It helps students understand how things work in relation to each other, how things are connected, what can happen in terms of sequencing. And the very things that are missing in much of formal education at the moment is supplied by the makerspace culture. So they prop up, one of the things that's beautiful about the makerspace movement is that they are propping up all over the place. They're in libraries, people start them up at private groups. They're also in small schools, big schools. They're all over. It's hard to say. But they all have that in common. They all have this sense of discovery that's not possible through what we now know as formal education.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about makerspaces today on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. So walk me through, what is something that, I gather from looking at the materials and all of that, that makerspaces pretty much can run the gamut. You can start as early as 3 or 4 years old.
That's right.
And run all the way, literally right up to the grave. Mm-hmm. But just for the sake of getting people to wrap their heads around this, if they're not familiar with the culture and the concept, let's start with a 9-year-old boy. I mean, that's an age that is difficult in traditional education because a lot of the models encourage boys to sit, and boys do not like to sit. they don't. They want to move around. They want to do things with their hands. What's the kind of activity Kim, you would have them doing in a makerspace?
Well, I have the personal experience of having a grandson who, like every grandparent, would expect as the smartest young man in the world. Yeah. But I want to tell a story about how he was able to craft some book bag tags for his class. Yeah. And he was staying the night at our house, and around 10 o'clock, his grandmother, my wife, was saying it's about time for bed. But this is an enthusiasm that crosses bedtime. And he said to me, "Poppy, do I have to go to bed?" And I said, no, you go ahead and keep making stuff, and I'll take care of Grandma. I think that enthusiasm was the same.
If Grandma is listening right now, you're going to pay for that one, I suspect.
it's the enthusiasm I felt when, as an undergrad at Purdue, I was introduced to computers, and you'd spend all night. And as today, probably around Indianapolis, people who are living what they love and learning can be a love relationship will recognize. These makerspaces are problem delivery devices. That is to say that you walk in with an idea to make something, but invariably there's unexpected problems that pop up. And that experience of solving problems creates sort of a confidence, this culture we've talked about before. And as I experienced with my goat and grandson, a sort of an attitude, really, about being able to solve problems. And I think if there's something we want to share with every kid, you know, in IPS and the township schools everywhere, it's that confidence that despite the problems, they can solve them.
Oh.
Kim reminded me of experiences that I've had with students. I taught university level in the UK and here in the States for the last 30 years. And many of my university students in art and design, specifically like three-dimensional design, experience this. It's really special to see people discovering their abilities to solve problems through hands-on learning. Of course, it happens a lot in art colleges, and it's one reason why I'm involved with First Makerspace. That's my background. But the art college experience of learning through your hands is something that I think is relevant to a much broader range of people. And we're finding that First Makerspace and Makerspaces in general is finding that some of those problem-solving techniques is really important to a much broader range of people.
And in terms of sort of the jump-off question here, what kind of, is it a prescribed problem you would have at where you say, okay, in the case of Kim's grandson, we want you to make some book bag tags for us, or does the child bring the problem to the makerspace, or does it work either way, Adam?
Well, in a makerspace environment in a school, we're helping the teachers understand how we can connect formal to informal education, and that's going to require programming and curriculum that's connected to what the kids are learning in school. So it's a lot of guided activities that are happening in makerspaces in the in-school time. Out of school, they can be a little bit more informal with enrichment activities. But what happened with my nephew, Kim's grandson, is sort of the bonus. That's what happens when a kid is exposed to making. But in an educational environment, we're going to be empowering teachers and arming them with activities and curriculum that guide the children through a learning experience that involves trial and error and iteration, so that they can make something, see how it fails, learn from it, try something else. And it's that process that we feel will get the most engagement out of the students.
Well, and I'm guessing, I'm going to stay with you for a second, Adam. I am guessing, though, if you're doing that and you're presenting the problems to these students, you have to keep presenting new problems, because unless elementary school, middle school, and high school students have changed, they share the solutions with each other. So you lose part of the lesson. How often do you have to renew that kind of curricular support?
Oh, it will be ongoing. I mean, the activities and programming in a makerspace are ongoing, the same as math assignments throughout the weeks and months of a school year for in-school learning. Now, we think that makerspace is going to apply to all subjects. Mm-hmm. There are really no subjects that you wouldn't be able to address in a makerspace setting.
I think that we can also say with some certainty that the most important problems are your problems, the ones you desire to solve. It's the element of personal mission that I think gives this student the runway to explore their own creativity, to really answer the question, why do I have to learn this stuff? Mm-hmm. You know, there's nothing so important as a problem in geometry when you can't build what you want on a 3D printer without knowing how that works.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about makerspaces and the makerspace movement or culture here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are all from First Makerspace. They are Kim Brand, the founder, the VP of Operations, Adam, and Arlen Bayless, who is the Creativity Director. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about makerspaces. They're an approach to enhancing creativity and developing problem-solving skills. My guests are First Makerspace founder Kim Brand, his son, who's also the Vice President of Operations for First Makerspace, Adam Brand, and Arlen Bayless, who's the Creativity Director for First Makerspace. Well, Kim, I'm going to ask here, what got you into this? I mean, you know, as founder, why? What drew you toward doing this?
Well, about 3.5 years ago, a friend who had also been a customer had an exit from a business. He's a pretty impulsive guy, and now armed with a bunch of money, he decided to make an investment in a 3D printing company. And so we founded 3D Parts Manufacturing. And there we had about $1.5 million worth of industrial commercial 3D printing gear. And it was actually at a exhibit at Connor Prairie. I think it was Creativity Fair, where I bumped into an engineer who had essentially applied some open source technology to the construction of a desktop 3D printer. Well, it wasn't too long before we had a couple dozen of them. We funded a program with TechPoint Foundation for Youth, where we installed them in schools, and we really just wondered what they might do. And we were very happily surprised that kids just got totally jazzed about making. Of course, 3D printing is pretty cool all by itself. But after we had built more printers and we put them in more schools, I think to date we've put printers in about 30 schools, we discovered that 3D printers were the trick that got kids interested, but every kid wants to be a maker. And we became aware of the maker movement and the impact it was having all over the country, over 100,000 attendees at maker fairs on both coasts are typical now. And with that information, with that ambition to make a bigger impact, we founded First Makerspace. And we were very happy to have partnerships with IPS at both Tech High School, where my dad graduated in 1949, and Shortridge, that allowed us to build makerspaces there to pursue that vision of bringing making into the education environment.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Mary, and if you'd like to reach out to us via email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Mary says, there are maker fairs across the nation where people can display their creations and share the directions with others. Not promoting the magazine Make, but it is incredible for information about homemade creations, problem-solving, makerspaces across the nation, and the location of maker fairs. Everything is open for sharing and is a wonderful source for young creators. I'm just saying there is a huge culture out there for people who want to create. Mm-hmm. Glad to hear this program. Thanks, Mary. Well, let's talk a little bit about the development of this culture. And we've talked about, at some level, how important collaboration is, but we haven't really explored that. Arlen, why is collaboration so important to the makers movement and culture?
Well, first of all, I think it's really significant that this making idea is springing up in so many different places.
That it's organic.
Grassroots. Right? Yeah, it's organic. And that, to me, is a signal of just how much it's needed. Almost like something organic, like a plant that's spreading. It's growing up in all these different places. Wherever there's a crack, it'll grow to come through. And I think we need to think about that. Why is it happening in lots of different places? I think that's an indication that there's a real need for it that isn't met. Now, it's organic nature. The fact that it can be a mindset is part of it, too. I think formal education certainly pushes a lot of collaborative thinking. I don't think formal education, I'm sure a lot of educators would agree with me, is as equipped as it would like to be to put into action a lot of that collaborative thinking. And so makerspaces, whether you're in school or out of school, is providing a way for you to put into action some collaborative ideas and to benefit from networking, something that we all do a whole lot more these days than we did 20 or 30 years ago.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about makerspaces here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Katie has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Katie, welcome to the program.
Yes, I've always been a fan of project-based learning, which is often used in a kind of traditional curriculum to foster creativity and problem solving. A concern that I've often had with that type of curriculum is that teachers will often invent a problem for a child to solve and or a group of children to solve. And then, you know, they solve that problem. And then a few weeks later, they come up with another invented problem for children to solve. And I always had some concerns about this, that the you know, you're not being honest with the students, and not only are there some ethical concerns about that, but also it's going to lose its effectiveness after a while because kids are going to go, okay, here's a new made-up scenario we have to deal with. But then also there's so many problems in the world that kids can solve, you know, as valued members of our community, and it would help, you know, give them empowerment and a sense of ownership in our society if they were actually, you know, solving real problems. And I heard earlier that they were talking about, you know, keeping, you know, everything fresh because kids do share solutions or, you know, oftentimes just out of excitement for things. So that was the comment that I wanted to offer.
Thanks very much for the call. I think all three of the panelists have something to say. They were all nodding their heads while you were talking. So thanks very much for the call, Katie. Certainly.
Thank you.
Arlen had his finger up first, so I'm going to give him first crack, but everybody will get a shot at this one.
I find this personally very interesting. For me as a teacher, one of the hardest things for me to learn was to be quiet, to shut up and let students think, to let them provide answers for themselves. And it takes an awful lot of self-discipline, especially when you have a good solution to a problem. However, having said that, our education director, it's a shame she can't be here today, Bethany, she talks about this a great deal. She will prime the pump by giving students one particular example, but then resist the temptation to do that again so that you can draw out of the students the sorts of things that they need to be thinking about.
Kim, you were second.
I was going to say my friend Ryan Stoyer with a company called Magnify Learning is a project-based learning consultant, and he's taught me so much. And if you just Google PBL, there's quite a treasure chest of pedagogy and technique that experts in PBL have developed over the years. But to Katie's point, it has to be personal. Mm-hmm. It has to be a problem that is solved with the passion, with the fire that burns in your belly. Because, frankly, some solutions are hard. And in fact, it's solving the hardest problems which give those makers the best sort of result. And I'd like to analogize it to sports. No one in sports expects to have a great outcome unless they work hard at it. But what I think we lack today is the motivation in many subject areas for kids to throw themselves at problems in class in an academic setting the way they do on the field. And if there's one outcome we'd like to have of makerspaces is that we have the same enthusiasm for learning that athletes have for performance.
How important is failure to all of the Adam? Everybody's springing up Adam. Okay.
Yeah. Well, we feel that failure is the sort of the cornerstone to making and enthusiasm for learning. We think that you can learn the most through failure, and more to Katie's point that we feel that a lot of the times the problems are sort of invented. And the solutions are known, but they're sort of waiting for the kids to stumble upon them. We feel that you set them up in a different way by creating projects that allow them to explore where there really is no end or solution. But kids are so naturally inquisitive and love to share, despite toddlers. Mm-hmm. But once they get a little bit older, when they start to stumble upon answers and solutions to problems, they just beam, and they love to gather around, and other kids are really interested in how they might have solved those problems. So it really just spreads like wildfire once you get these kids in this type of an environment.
We've gotten a question from a listener named Gene via Facebook. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Gene says, what kind of impact do you see in terms of learning 3D sculpture for the design aspect for kids in high school? The end result of the print is great, but does it also foster the same amount of design learning? Arlen, I'm thinking you're probably the only one who really understands what's being asked there.
No, I think these two would too, because okay. They both make stuff. I know Adam and Kim both make things with their hands in their workshops. It's really important. One thing that I've noticed teaching university students is that there's been an alarming increase of students that struggle with one particular project I run, which is to create a cardboard chair. They'd have to think about how they want to make a cardboard chair, make drawings and models. However, it's only at the point of model making that many students now realize that this idea in 2D that they've got in their head doesn't work in 3D. And we live in a world of screens, like a lot of mm-hmm. screens that we look at. Even adults do that too. Mm-hmm. Kids certainly look at two-dimensional world a lot more than we used to. And because of that, I think it's hard for students to imagine something in three dimensions, and especially manipulating things in space. What that does to overall cognitive learning is, you know, being studied. It's quite possible that there's a lot of other connections that people don't make that have nothing to do with models, but are other kinds of cognitive connections that are very important for people to make, and that as young people, they need to be working with their hands, with three-dimensional things just as much.
I apologize Please. For jumping in, but no. I have to reference, and your readers may recognize, the work of Escher. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. Escher could draw things that could never be made. Mm-hmm. And there is that moment, that crisis that occurs when you've drawn something, and then you go to make it, and you can't make it. It doesn't turn out mm-hmm. right. The corners aren't perfect. The thicknesses, the materials don't behave the way you expect. Or if in case it's a material that changes with the weather, the reality
right.
that we live in.
What that does
is a substitute for virtual reality. I mean, we used to only deal with reality.
But if you translate that to a problem-solving situation, that means that a person who thinks of an idea, they have a solution for an idea, they think that's possible. If they realize that in three dimensions it's not possible, then maybe they'll realize that in real life, applying an idea to something has to be tested in real life. It has to be tested in a community environment, if it's an idea for an office or something like that.
So there's an application of scientific method at some level here, that all hypotheses must be tested.
But I think it applies to the way people relate to the world themselves
too.
In the world as well, and their relationships with one another.
Yeah. We've gotten another question via Facebook, and again, if you want to find us on Facebook, we're at No Limits WFYI. This is from a listener named Gordon, whom I teach with at Franklin College. Hi, Gordon. Thanks for listening. For years, I've been wanting to start a makerspace for all ages in Franklin. We've been looking at buildings that we could try to convert into a space that would work. My question is about funding. Since I am not sitting on large piles of cash and this is not something that necessarily brings in a lot of direct revenue, what kind of federal, state, city funds are there, or grants?
Well, yeah. I wish I had a better answer. I know that they're out there. We just talked this morning with a principal in southern Indiana who's hunting for cash in a 21st century grant. We've talked with local benefactors and beneficiaries, and one of a lot of really generous people, but one that stands out is Pat Corsi, who helped fund our summer camp program where we had almost 600 kids this year. You know, I think funding will follow good ideas. Mm-hmm. And if we can demonstrate that we can move the needle on a bunch of underserved populations to be more inquisitive, do better on their math, science, and English mm-hmm. scores, I think that that will cease to be a problem. However, to your point, I would say that your best, most likely pathway to some funding for a community makerspace may be in league with a library, perhaps in a corner of a museum, or as we've seen here in Indianapolis, with a local school that would dedicate some space, and perhaps Franklin College is one of them. We'd love to see more makerspaces everywhere.
What is the cost? Can you give me a range of setting up a makerspace? I mean, what at the low end, what can you do it for? At the high end, what do you do it for? Adam, they're all looking at you, so clearly you're the money guy.
Well, sort of, yes. Unfortunately, I don't know where to find it all. From a pricing standpoint, makerspaces, like Kim alluded to, can be free because it's one between your head, so you can, you're between your ears. You find some materials and you make something, but I think what we're really looking at is to provide a space that has adequate equipment and access for people to explore their, you know, making potential. Free all the way to tens of thousands of dollars. I mean, the sky's really the limit. I mean, if you were to give somebody like me an open checkbook, it would incorporate all sorts of woodworking equipment and metalworking equipment. And I mean, if you just take a look at my garage, all the tools and clamps and screwdrivers and all those sorts of things. If you were to outfit something like that where you could make anything that you could imagine, you could fill it with a lot of stuff. Now, unfortunately, there are a lot of people that would like to make but don't have any idea what tools are required to make what they want to make. They don't know what the laser cutting technology is or the 3D printing capabilities are and where to find that sort of information. And that's part of our mission, is to change that. You put it in the schools and then they get it when they're young, and then they grow up with access to that sort of an incubator to explore their ideas. But from a cost standpoint, it can be as small as an organic closet cart that's full of making materials that they can pull out and do activities in the school. We are hoping to bridge the gap between when the education policy catches up mm-hmm. with the demand for making in schools. Until that happens, we need to find through philanthropic funds mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. communities.
What's the absolute essential minimum things, equipment that you need for a makerspace, would you say?
I believe that it
obviously a brain.
Yeah, it begins with materials you're choosing to work with. Ruckus here in town, a makerspace that's being launched by the Raleigh Area Development, is going to focus a lot on sewing and textiles. And so there you need sewing machines. We sort of lean on 3D printers and laser cutters. But you can get a lot of bang for the buck. And I talked with a Carmel teacher last week that's doing it with a cart and cardboard and glue guns. I think that perhaps to put the emphasis on the money is the wrong place to be initially concerned. I think it's really what materials are at hand, where can you find the recyclables in the space, where can you create a community that can share?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Don't you think, Arlen?
Mm-hmm.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about makerspaces. They are an approach to developing problem-solving skills and enhancing creativity. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are all from First Makerspace. They are the founder, Kim Brand, his son, who's the Vice President of Operations, Adam, and Arlen Bayless, who is the Creativity Director. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're talking about makerspaces today on No Limits. Those are they're an approach to developing problem-solving skills and enhancing creativity from people who are ridiculously young to right up to the to the grave itself. My guests are First Makerspace founder Kim Brand, his son, who's the Vice President of Operations for First Makerspace, Adam, and First Makerspace's Creativity Director, Arlen Bayless. I think it was a question we got, email question from Mary, who alluded to this culture. We focused most of our conversation thus far on education and really, you know, primary and secondary education for the most part, a little bit college. But we shouldn't limit it to that. Makerspaces are part of life for people of all ages. Go ahead, Adam. Yes.
Oh, well, I just wanted to agree with Mary. There is a huge rising tide in making. And one of those key acronyms that's sort of synonymous with making is DIY. You'll see if you're an avid social media user, web browser, the increase over the last several years in advertising towards making, you know, doing things yourself, and the recipe videos on, you know, cooking can also be, you know, attributed to making, woodworking. There's really no limit to the number of things that you can sort of take on and do yourself, and that's one of those cultures we're trying to promote and get people access to.
And I can just add that there is an adult makerspace, a membership organization called Siberia Limited at 30th and Shadlin. They have been a real resource for
Where did the name come from? I'm sorry.
You know, there's a story. You'd have to ask one of the guys who founded the organization. I'm afraid I can't be can't articulate. But the tools they have mostly contributed. This is a membership organization where for $35 a month you can come and use the tools and share the community and learn. They've got ham radio gear there. They've got metalworking tools, some woodworking equipment. And probably more than anything else, they've got this attitude that you come and you need help to make it and we're going to be there with you. It's a part of really a larger social phenomenon, I think, which we would identify with the sharing economy. You got a tool, you don't use it so much, you bring it down to the makerspace and let other people use it.
We are talking about makerspaces here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named David has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. David, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to bring your attention to an organization up in Fort Wayne called Tech Venture, and they've been in operation for, at least 10 years. They've been in trailers, they've been in, you know, a number of different spaces, but they've secured a building, and they're looking for a new building, and they're partnering with St. Francis, the College of St. Francis. They have a lot of material, equipment that you were just referencing, that were things that were donated. Given to them. The funding for makerspaces is very, very hard to get a lot of times. And, you know, the person who runs that, Greg Jacobs, has looked high and low for funding. And the partnership with St. Francis is something that he hopes is certainly going to come about. And then the city of Fort Wayne has expressed interest in helping them as well. But they're a great model that I didn't know that you may not be aware of. I also wanted to say hi to Arlen, too, because he served as my advisor when I set up the glass studio at the Indianapolis Arts Center.
So
I'm glad
hi,
you
David.
Have him there. He's terrific.
It's good to hear your voice.
So check out Tech Venture. They could be a great resource for other makerspaces here in Indianapolis.
Thanks very much for the call, David.
Sure, thanks.
Thank you.
Kim. There's another commercial model, Tech Shop, and the city has solicited Tech Shop to possibly bring one of their adult makerspaces to town. These are $1.5-2 million enterprises with equipment ranging from, you know, what I think of as commercial and industrial mills and lathes and metalworking gear, water jet cutters, and the full gamut. The concept there is urban manufacturing. It's bringing the entrepreneur with a great idea who needs short-run, highly iterative manufacturing capacity to low-scale, small-scale production that can demonstrate a product and maybe earn funding from venture capitalists. So you can also check out Tech Shop. I believe that they're still considering a location in Indianapolis.
Is there, I mean, it seems to me that there would be a funding model, because I'm oversimplifying, probably going to make economists' head explode there with what I'm going to say. But really, capitalism itself is you get rewarded for solving a particular problem.
Right.
That's the motivation is all in problem solving. It would strike me that that one of the ways you could create a model here is by saying, okay, we will put this problem, which is a real problem, in front of a lot of young creative minds, and, you know, we expect something in return for solving the problem. Kim, you had your hand up, but then you pointed at Arlen.
Well, we both have something to contribute, and Arlen probably more than me, but I visited at a makerspace funded substantially by General Electric in Louisville. Yeah. It's called First Build. And there, they let the community participate for free. Their engineers can enjoy the resources of a fully fleshed out makerspace to try to accelerate product development that would otherwise get stuck for months or years in a corporate R&D lab, but which over a few weekends, certainly over a period of time denominated in weeks, not months, you can kick the tires on a new product and see what happens. And they've developed several products there. So there's also a corporate incentive to either fund, sponsor, or otherwise get engaged with makerspaces for the benefit of their employees and ultimately their bottom line.
Arlen.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we see happening is that open sourcing, you only have to look at Apple or Tesla that have decided, you know, it's better to leave a lot of these things open for people to contribute to. That's a really sophisticated way of thinking and says no to a lot of old paradigms that we're used to living with, which is wonderful because that suits the next generation. And we're going to see things come out of that generation that we haven't seen for a long time.
How much of this is I'm going to take us back to education for a second. I do want to save some time so we can talk about some of the events you've got coming up this fall. But in terms of education, how much of this is that we are still working with outdated educational models, ones that encourage individual achievement, because it sounds like a lot of this, the problem solving involves working together, collaboration. And I'm not going to lay it all at the educational system, because I know, without going into too many details, my cousin was a superintendent elsewhere in the country at a very high-achieving school system, and decided to dispense with the categories of, you know, identifying students as valedictorians or salutatorians, in part because, you know, her argument was, these kids, we don't need to teach them anything more about competing. They're competing, you know, from the minute they hit the school grounds. We need to teach them how to work together better.
Would that the world was simple.
Yeah.
I think we've allowed to persist way too long a factory model of education. When I went to school, I got a great education, but the chairs and desks were aligned in rows and columns, and the teacher at the front of the room was dispensing knowledge that I couldn't find anywhere else. I still remember, you know, an afternoon assigned to the library in term papers with note cards. You know, how long has it been since those are relevant? So we do need to take advantage of some of the new technology, but also respect some of the old, you know, sort of philosophy of having a problem and being left to solve it and asking your friends about where the best resources are. And we need to accept the fact that perhaps assessments are a double-edged sword. They also set a floor as well as a ceiling. And if you can't assess something, does that mean that it's not relevant? You know, we're watching Olympic athletes now compete in sports that are not quite so easy to measure. Like, for example, gymnastics. And I think that that juries and contribution of experts to the portfolio of a student are really where education needs to move, and away from, you know, filling in bubbles with number two lead pencils.
We've and I should talk, because I'm afraid we will run out of time, a little bit about what you have coming up this autumn. I'll start, Adam.
Well, we have our education director, Bethany Thomas, has spent a lot of time planning out our spaces that we have to make making and other activities available. We do a good amount of Saturday and evening programming at the Brownsburg Library, such as our 3D printer certification program that allows people in the community to come in and learn how to use a 3D printer so that once they're certified, they can come in and use it whenever they want. We've got intro to 3D printing CAD design using Tinkercad, even a girls-only STEAM makers lock-in. We call it STEAM. The maker movement is really changing the name of STEM to STEAM, incorporating art in there. And then we've got our two major makerspaces at Arsenal Tech and Shortridge that both have some programming. In fact, Kim is going to be hosting our very first home mechanics, as we call it, home mech. It's painting, plumbing, wiring, and more. So being sort of empowering yourself to know how to change out a light switch and do some of the things that you might be a little intimidated to do in the home. 3D printer open making is also sort of tying in with the certification at Brownsburg. You can just come in if you want to print something you've never really known what it is, and you want to learn a little bit more about 3D printing, you can come to Shortridge. All this information is on our website at firsttomakerspace.com. Check it out and sign up for a program.
Is there a cost to attend?
Some of these are do cost, but usually the cost is fairly inexpensive, on the order of about $30 for a session for a couple hours.
Okay. We've gotten an email that picks up on one of your points about the lock-in for the girls from a listener named Barbara. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Barbara says, I know these guests are advocates for makerspaces for all, but be sure to check gender roles at the door. Makerspaces in my generation were home ec for girls and shop for boys. The potential propensity to have these modern-day makerspaces more naturally accommodate boys more than girls needs to be avoided. Mm-mm. And to extrapolate this idea, it may be that girls in makerspaces with other girls and with qualified mentors may thrive in ways that traditionally boys have been more encouraged to excel.
It's huge. Yeah, it's absolutely huge. And when you look at the Maker Mindspace, you'll find that there is already a really well-established place for girls. For women thinkers and the way women think, it's part of that Maker mindset. Women are taking part in all kinds of activities they didn't used to take part in before.
There's an actual thing. You can find out about something called wearables, and it seems to appeal more to girls. And so they're using electronics and conductive threads and LEDs and batteries, and they're designing fashion. So we embrace sewing as if it were a female art form, but we find just as many boys get involved in that. So it's an equity-generating activity.
And it's top of mind for us on a daily basis when we're defining and planning and curriculum, where we're always talking about how we can be 100% inclusive. Bethany, of course, is always very mindful of that. So we are we're always making sure that we break down those traditional gender roles and make sure that it's available to everyone, and no one person should benefit over another.
We've gotten another email from a listener named John, and again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. John says, please have your guests talk about the need for future teachers to learn about makerspaces and how to incorporate the makerspace philosophy into their elementary ed curriculum in particular. Kim.
Well, one of the challenges for us putting makerspaces in schools is the lack of a shop class experience over the last couple generations, in fact. And so when educators are faced with the challenge of incorporating maker pedagogy, they have no experience. And so we're reaching out to the undergrad schools of education in the state to help enable them to embrace making skills and the education benefits that it can provide by, you know, giving undergrad ed students experiences in making.
How much of that is also, I mean, so much of elementary and secondary education curricula these days prescribed by the state or by mm-hmm. politicians that the, you know,
it's a big issue. Of course, you know, we could spend all day, you know, talking about the problems with formal education. But you know, I don't think anybody that thought of the No Child Left Behind or ESSA had bad intentions. I think we tried to do things to help, and oftentimes they don't work the first time out. It's a big and slow machine. And the one thing about makerspaces is it's able to provide a solution now. It's going to take a while to change education, but makerspaces can provide solutions right now.
Yeah, we're working with University of Indianapolis, as a matter of fact, and also with Marion. We've got friends at IUPUI and Ivy Tech. Talked with educators from Ball State and Butler. So there's a great interest right now, and I believe that the solutions we develop here in Central Indiana could, in fact, be models for the rest of the country. And I'd like to think that our business, among others, will ride the track of an Angie's List or an Exact Target or interactive intelligence to basically bring this to what are in the state, you know, a million students, and in the country over 130,000 schools.
Suppose I'm listening to this and I'm a parent and my school is not on board, hasn't created the makerspace yet, but I want my child to have this kind of experience. How would I go about doing that in my own home, Adam?
Well, we think that it starts from the parents, and we think that with this policy gap where making is not a part of formal education yet, we feel that in the next 3 to 5 years with the current demand and making, we think it all comes from the parents. The parents just need to push. Mm-hmm. They need to talk to the administrations, talk to the principals, talk to their teachers, talk about the importance, find those other schools that are incorporating making and use them as examples. There are plenty of schools out there that are doing that.
Volunteer.
Know. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Well, how would I, but if I wanted to create like a makerspace within my own
totally.
Home
do
for my
with,
child, how do I do that?
Do it together with friends as well. Together, you only need one other group of parents that are interested also in putting together some tools. A few tools. There's plenty of online resources. That's one of the beautiful thing about it.
You would Make Magazine, for example, is
that Mary referenced to.
Exactly. Yeah. A great place to start.
Instructables
is great.
There is a market of that's aimed directly at your question.
Well, I'd like to thank, that's a good last word. I'd like to thank all three of my guests. All of them are from First Makerspace, the founder, Kim Brand, his son, who's the vice president of operations, Adam, and Arlen Bayless, who is the creativity director. It's been a fascinating conversation. I've learned a lot listening to you guys. Thank you
Stop by our spaces anytime.
I will take you up on that, I promise. Also like to thank our listeners for some great questions and comments and invite everybody to come back on Thursday when we're going to continue our exploration of Central Indiana's waterways and what they mean to this part of the country. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.